Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we always look forward to having Daniel Golden with us, and he is back. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, here in the studio with me today, and he's got a whole lot of books in front of him right now, and we'll be talking about all of them as we move along today. He's got his list of books for the year, and maybe you've got a list too. What's your favorite book to give during the holidays? Where do you find reading recommendations? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Golden, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, is it just me, or are there more and more books being published? I actually looked this up.
Yes, I would love, I love the results, please.
The results for 2023, they're expecting somewhere between 800,000 and a million books to be published. And if you add in self-published, it goes to 4 million.
Yes, and the thing about it's a much grayer area than you would think between traditionally published books and self-published books, because in the middle are all these kind of contract published and mill published books. So sometimes people pay part of the fee. Sometimes they're still, the publisher says we're a traditional publisher, and you know, but there is payment involved. And with mill publish, there's a lot of publishers that will publish huge numbers of books very cheaply and expect that you'll be buying most of them, you know, to give away and various things. And then the other things they just put online, which there's so much, there's a low barrier entry to publish. There's a low barrier entry for eBooks. And all of that means more. But it's interesting you say that, because we have, you know, even our, in our store, I mean, we can control how many books come in, but just to take the paper ARCs, advanced readers copies, galleys, whatever we call them, the largest publisher, Penguin Random House, does fewer and fewer of them, but all the little publishers seem to be doing more or sending more to us. So every year we're like, we're running out of room faster, And like every month we go through, we move December here and January there. And like we're giving boxes away to organizations and we can't keep up. It just becomes overwhelming. And that's with very few. We get a few duplicates, but really not that many. They want, they're looking for people to read the book. That's a big part of marketing campaigns, is finding a reader, perhaps like me, perhaps any other bookseller, perhaps an Instagram influencer, perhaps just a local critic, probably you. I'm sure anybody would want you to read their book. I'm sure. I can't imagine that anybody ever says to you, Larry, you should read my book.
We are. I've been told by some authors that the being on the show has made a kind of big impact in their sales. You know, thinking about, somebody asked me about this once, and they said, well, let's say an author who's got a, is a pretty good author and has had many books that are pretty sold very well. What percentage of that $25 or whatever the book costs, or 30, does the author actually get?
Well, royalties are actually contracts, so it really is very different for every author. You get a better percentage. Like, not only do you, not only is your hardcover more, but in most cases, you get a higher royalty for a hardcover than a paperback. You get a different royalty for eBooks. You get a different royalty for that audio book that's almost always downloaded. And then if you go into a store and they have like $4.99 or $9.99 bargain books, you probably didn't get anything. You know, that's a different method getting the books in. And nowadays, so many books are bought secondhand and on marketplaces, they don't get any money for that either. So you have to think not just how much money do they get. And I can't give you an exact number, because it's always changing.
Yeah, it could be 20% or 10%. You have no idea.
Well, and the other thing is if every author negotiates from a traditional publisher, negotiates in advance, and then those royalties are against the advance. So you don't actually earn money until you pay out the advance. And your advance doesn't only go to you. It goes to your agent. It might go to a manager, a lawyer. As well. So, you know, the world of books is better than, you know, the old world of music. Like if they did you get somebody else and they spend $200,000 on a movie, a music video, that would go against your advance. And so you wouldn't earn money from that. That's not the way marketing works for the most part in book publishing. Like if they spend money on a tour or advertising, that's not against your advance. But in other worlds, it is. So it could be worse.
It could be worth,
but it's not that much per book.
In terms of trends, types of books that you're seeing more of, let's put it that way.
Well, I think I've talked before about the rise of romance and the rise of fantasy, but really one of the very big trends is romanticy, which is the merger of romance and fantasy. We just did a virtual event for an author named Freya Marsk yesterday. And it was, I have a lot of books on staff who read her. She has a trilogy, a number of different books, but it's called The Last Binding. They're all series.
Yeah.
They sort of look the way YA looked 10 years ago, but these are, the readers are aging up and the authors like that there's less restrictions on what they can write. Her book is called A Power Unbound. It's the third book in the trilogy. And it's, very much romantic-y. And that's one trend that we're seeing a lot of. A lot of times it's, there's still a lot of attempts for more inclusion of unheard voices. And I think we're getting into more specific, not just people of color, but maybe this author is, Ghana from, has an American heritage, is American, but his family's from Ghana, or this person's from Colombia. Like we're seeing a lot more, with indigenous writers, like what tribe are you from? Mm-hmm. What part of the country? Because you'll have a different experience. So you see that a lot in the awards.
You go. Michael in Kakana has something, a question or a comment relating to all this. Let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I have in the past used Amazon's publishing service. I'm not even sure it's available anymore. I kind of missed the beginning of the show. But I did a couple of vanity publications, and they turned out really, really nice and very little cost that I could buy, give away to friends. One had a bunch of old family stories in it. One was basically a picture book of pets. And they were very, very well received as gifts for family members.
Oh,
And they are still doing that. And, the big thing is, when somebody, there's all different platforms that people can use, and I'm not an expert on it, but as independent bookstores, we always recommend a platform called Ingram Spark, which is, which allows bookstores to carry the book. So what you're finding is in the old days, a lot of local writers would want, if they didn't have traditional distribution, they'd want you to take their books on consignment. And we do still a little of it. Some stores do a lot of it. But a lot of stores are basically saying, you got to put your book on Ingram Spark. And it has to be at these terms if you want us to carry the book. And now I say, for a lot of authors, you want your, there's probably one bookstore that can sell your book, your local bookstore. If you're not driving people to that bookstore, it's going to be really tough. Yeah. Of course, quirky contract published books break out all the time, but that's a tiny, tiny percentage of it.
Yeah.
And so, every author has to make the decision of what they want to do. And we respect that decision, but then we act, as do bookstores all over the state and the country, on, based on the decision you made, what are we going to do? It's funny that this is not a place to complain, and I'm not complaining. I just find it funny that when authors will talk to me as they'll say, I'm a local author. You should bring me in. I was like, where do you live? Oh, you know, Rice Lake. And I was like, how? So that means you come into Milwaukee? Like, so you're shopping with us, you're local. So you shop with me like what, once a week? And they're like, oh, I haven't been to your store. So that people have a different idea of local based on whether they're the writer or the consumer. And we basically say to them, this is great, but you need to be close enough to drive folks into the store. We're not a magic wand. We don't, you know, I'm not going to be able to take your book and sell it just because I put it out. There's a lot of books in my store. But there probably is someplace else. And so I'll sometimes talk to authors. I'm like, you don't have a bookstore in town. Maybe there's a gift shop that could sell your book. If you know there's some people who you probably already maxed out the online purchasing, like people will come to us like 6 months after the book's out and say, you know, carry my book. And we'll look at their site and it'll say, buy me on Amazon. And it's been that way for a long time. And that's not a critique. You do what you need to. Everybody needs to do what they need to do. But then I might have to say to them, yeah, I think you've probably maxed out most of your sales. So you have to figure out if you think there are sales on the table, it might not be us. But the truth is a lot of coaches on self-publishing, a lot of platforms will say to do that. It's like, use the bookstore as your second phase. You know, get all the sales you can yourself and then go to the bookstore. And of course, if you talk to any bookstore, they're like, we might want to be in that first phase.
Daniel Golden, our guest today. Oh man, he is the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. And I tell you what, There's not a town that I go to that if I'm going to be around at least for the day, and I'm not just there for a 1 hour meeting and then have to leave, I'll go to the bookstores, the independents, and it's always a fascinating experience that I buy a book. If I go, I buy a book. I can always find one that I like, and that's what I like about bookstores, and. For me, it's always an interesting experience. It's always fun to see what kinds of marketing's going on locally and kind of what things they're doing, events.
There's also a wonderful resource if you travel around Wisconsin or the upper Midwest. It's called MidwestBooksellers.org. And they have little, like, because sometimes, you know, of course you can just go online and type in bookstore near me. But sometimes there is something called bookstore tourism where you want to go seek out stores and maybe you'll make a decision to go to a town based on, you know, maybe I want to go to Genesee Depot and go to Whistle Stop Rare Books, or maybe I want to go to, Spinster Books in Ashland. I don't know. And there are, you know, you can go on their website first. You can go read reviews and stuff and see if it's the kind of thing you want.
Yeah, it's always, always a lot of fun. And there are probably some listeners right now that who are saying, Mueller, when are you going to ask Daniel about books that he's recommending?
No.
We haven't even gotten to that yet, but we will get to that right next, as a matter of fact. He's got a whole great list. In the meantime, let me remind you that Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Denner is our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. If you're looking for a good holiday gift, what about a good book? What about a book for yourself? We're going to give you some ideas about books. Daniel Golden, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, our guest today, and he's got a list of 20-some books that he's recommending for the holiday season. It covers a broad range, and I'm looking forward to talking with him about them. And let's get to that list, Daniel. The first book you have is The Globe Makers. It's a beauty, I guess. Tell us about it.
Yes, ooh, it is a beauty. It is a really great price at $30. It is full color. And it is about, so this, there's a little backstory on the book. Peter Bellamy wanted to buy a globe for his 80-year-old father, and he wanted something kind of old-fashioned, artisan, handmade, and he couldn't find one. People just weren't doing it. So he said, I will start a globe business. And it turned out to be a lot more complicated than he thought. And my interest in this came twofold. One, Our customers love books about maps. They love maps every year. History and maps, wine and maps, this and maps. And I also, another book that was really popular with our book clubs and readers in the last couple of years is called Still Life by Sarah Widman. To put it bluntly, it's about working class people finding their happiness through art in Italy. But one of them is a globe maker. And there's a lot of talk about making globes. And I thought, and my colleague Tim read the book and loved it. And our buyer Jason was going to pick it. And I thought, oh, this is a perfect book. And it's all the complications, of course, and the story, but also like the politics of globe making, the history, the politics, the complications, how to fit things on the map correctly, what kind of information should you have on it, how, you know, the mathematics of fitting the pieces on. As you can see, this is the way, you know.
Beautifully illustrated, by the way.
It's a really cool book.
Anyway. Well, that's number one. And you had film director Alfred Hitchcock. Many books written about him, but what about this latest one?
So this
one
is called Hitchcock's Blondes by Lawrence Leamer. And one of the things that I'm always interested in is finding people come in and ask about different categories. Like I said, somebody might come in about maps. A lot of people come in talking about film and, you know, asking about film books. And maybe not as many, you know, but people watch stream and watch things, Turner Classics movies online and all kind, you know, Prime and Max and Netflix and things like that. And a lot of them do show old films as well. So this is a slightly different take on Hitchcock because it is told through the perspective of not all, but some of his most biggest actresses who were in the business, from people you know, like Janet Leigh and Kim Novak, Eva Marie Saint, Grace Kelly, and also some people you, Tippi Hedren, and people you might know, like June Howard Tripp and Madeline Carroll. Apparently they were all either blonde, they dyed their hair sometimes to make Mr. Hitchcock happy. It is an eye-opening book because he was, especially in the context of today's culture, he was probably a difficult and problematic person sometimes. But honestly, it really depended on the actress, you know. And I was also fascinated the way sometimes, you know, they just had great experiences, and sometimes he was just brutal. And I don't know if he was reacting to who the actress was, how much he wanted them, how much power they had over him. So I really enjoyed this book a lot. The other thing that's interesting is he used a lot of, for source material, the papers of Patrick McGilligan, who is a Milwaukee film biographer, who's just wonderful film biographer, and as some of his source material. And so he got a thank you in the book, which I always like.
Well, let's see. We've got true crime stories are really popular. I know that I can see that on TV as well. The next book on your list is one of them. It's called The Art Thief.
Yes, and this is a book. So yes, our buyer put this book in true crime, and I think there is interest there. But I have to say, it is I quibbled with him after I read the book because I said, I think this is more for the art reader. So The Art Thief, The True Story of Love, Crime, and a Dangerous Obsession by Michael Finkel. He wrote a book called Stranger in the Woods that did very well. This also did very well. Is about a young man who stole, and I don't have a typo in my voice, $2 billion worth of art from
$2 billion.
Small museums and historical sites. And he would do it with his girlfriend, and they were so detailed in how they did this, and they always looked for the less protected items that were of interest to him. And there are different ways. I learned this. I just read a kid's book called Framed by James Ponti about art thievery in Washington, D.C. I read it with my great nephew and highly recommended for the 8 to 12 set. And this reminded me that there are different kinds of art thieves. You either sell it on the private market, you try to ransom it back to the owners, or you keep it like a crazy person. And that's what he did. So the art was all stored in the little apartment that he had upstairs from his mother, who didn't know what was going on. And when she found it, she tried to get it out of there and inadvertently destroyed a bunch of it. It was all eventually solved. And this is he is a unique individual who is willing to tell way more than most people would about what he did. Whenever I talk to any group that has a lot of volunteer art museum volunteers or docents or something, they go crazy for this book. And it's easy read, and I can say it satisfies readers from 16 to 62, because those are the youngest and the oldest people in the store who read it and recommended it.
Okay. Well, let's see. Next on your list is Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant by Curtis Chan. It sounds similar to a couple of other recent books about growing up in the U.S. with immigrant parents.
Yes. Astute listeners will catch that I'm grouped all the nonfiction together. And in fact, I always say to myself, I don't really read memoirs that much. And then I looked at this and I'm like, I just have four of them. Four of the 10 books are memoirs in one way or another. So Curtis Chan is film. He's involved in filmmaking. He's working on podcasts. In fact, we just hosted an author named Kevin Pang, who has a wonderful book that's almost like a memoir and cookbook called A Very Chinese Cookbook that he wrote with his father, Jeffrey Pang. They have a web series called Hunger Pangs. He's at America's Test Kitchen. It was really great, but I couldn't put that book on the list because I have this rule about cookbooks that I have to cook a certain number of recipes from them, and I just can't. So I'm lucky if I get one. So instead, I read a book, and this is about growing up in Detroit. This restaurant that his family had, which was not Chin's, it was Chung's, was in Detroit, and there's a fascinating backstory. It was in a neighborhood that was urban renewaled out for highways. And they took the Asian neighborhood, it was an old Chinatown, and they said, we're going to relocate you. And they put them in the most dangerous part of the city, the gas corridor, thinking, well, maybe they can make it better. Well, they could not make it better. And soon enough, Chung's was the only surviving, remnant relic of other restaurants and community centers and gift shops. And the family itself moved further out of town, but that was another problem because he grew up, the further they moved out of town, the less other Asian Americans there were, and the more he was, he was the subject to small slights and things like that. The book is about, the restaurant, I love books about restaurants. I like food books. We'll talk about that later. And this was an amazing institution. I also read several Detroit books because I went to Detroit for a bookseller conference, which was fun. Chung's over the court, it was legendary in Detroit. They sold 60 million egg rolls over the life of the book and a life of the bookstore. Not the bookstore, the food store. And I went to the block where the restaurant is, because there's a really wonderful bookstore called Source Booksellers. It's black-owned, but it's just a general nonfiction-focused store that's just one of the greatest stores, a wonderful proprietor. And I looked at where Chung's was. This is like when I run around to department stores saying, where was it? Especially when you read a book and it's nonfiction, you want to, if you get the chance, you want to see it. So on top of everything else, it's a lot of food. He has the only thing I'm upset about the book is he keeps talking about this thing called almond boneless chicken, and there's no recipe. And I'm like, I want to make that. So, And then on top of everything else, it is a bit of a coming out story for him. So it's another way he's different. But somebody said, when are you coming out to your parents in the book? And he said, that'll be in volume two. So it's not really too much of that. So
Daniel Golden, our guest today, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. We're taking a look at his book selections, maybe one for yourself or one for a gift during the holiday season. And I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've got a suggestion of your own, or maybe you have a question for Daniel. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. 642-1234, or you could email us. The email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And you have another memoir, and the title sounds, I'm sure it's the words from a song.
Yes, it's from Yes.
Owner of a Lonely Heart.
Yes, just to kind of show the diversity of experience, this is another AAPI story, but it's so different. You know, Curtis Chin's family came on their own volition. Beth Wynn's story is a refugee story. She's written other books before. She also is a Madisonian. She teaches at UW in the English department in creative writing. But it is a different... And she's had other books before. This is a very different story. For one thing, the way it's told is not a direct memoir, but a memoir in essays. So each segment is kind of dances around the central story, which is when they were in Vietnam and were her parents were not married, and her father escaped with her but didn't tell the mother and left the mom behind. The mother did escape also and went to Boston, the Boston area, but she didn't see her for 20 years. And so this is sort of the reckoning on top of everything else. It's her story and her mother's story. And as she becomes a mother herself, her attempt to reconcile with her own mother. So it's a very different take. We have a book club called Home that we work with sometimes at the Schlitz Audubon that reads refugee stories, and they really like this book a lot too.
So Owner of a Lonely Heart, and the author Beth
Wynn, or my sister who teaches Chinese, she's like, it's not exactly Wynn. It's actually, there's a little different inflection, but I said
N-G-U-Y-E-N.
Yeah, Claudia, I'm trying hard. So,
by the way, what's the difference between a memoir and an autobiography?
I don't know. But I would say an autobiography is sometimes more prominent. Like, a lot of memoirs are really just everyday people writing their lives. And I think sometimes autobiographies are tended to be more celebrity-driven. They were often as told to, so it was more clear that there was either a noted or unnoted ghostwriter. But I would say the line has blurred. A lot of celebrities really, really, really want to use memoir. To a certain extent, I would say autobiography is an out-of-date term. You just don't... I mean, it's not bad. It's not that you can't say it. It's just people don't use it as much.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
You never see it.
It's just... It's just the way it is.
Memoirs,
so the difference maybe is an autobiography was published in the 70s. Yeah. A memoir is published now.
Oh, man. And you think, why do you think there's so many of these again?
So many stories? Because everybody...
These kinds of
Everybody
memoirs.
Everybody wants to tell their story. I mean, if it's not a memoir, it's a long, boring story from me telling you about the time when I was 12 and did whatever. But I do think people get... You know, it really depends. You know, sometimes it's the writing style. Sometimes it's what they have to say. Sometimes what they have to say is important for the moment. So there are some memoirs that are very timely and others, some are timeless and some maybe didn't need to be there. But it's, you know, everyone has, you know, this is the thing. And we were talking about self-published versus traditional publishing. It's really just a question of whether other people believe in your whatever you've written enough to take it through to the next level. Like, everybody has to, you know, they have to put some skin on the game. They have to invest in everything. And if they don't, if somebody reads it and they either they're not interested in reading it or they don't get very far in it, you know, it there it is. It isn't anywhere.
You've got a big surprise for the next book, though.
It's my in between all the memoirs.
Who bought a book about pockets?
I was talking to my colleague Rachel, who is us. On top of everything else, she's a wonderful sewer. So, like, she does a lot of programs. And when she really likes a book, she designs an outfit. She sews an outfit for it. But she's not the only person who's talked to me about pockets. I was talking about this book. I said something. I just said, like, pocket. Here's a book, pockets.
And woman pockets, turned, you mean the, pocket the pockets that you in clothing. Have in your pants.
And a woman turned to me. She's like, you mean how most women's clothing doesn't have any? And if it does, they're way too small and we can't do anything with it. I'm like, that's exactly what this book is about. And it is basically a history of why pockets in women's clothing either are non-existent or are too small and you can't do anything about it. And there's even, I had a little group sale. I was like, my one for the adult, one for the kids. There's actually a children's book that came out this fall called A Dress with Pockets. And it is about a little girl who hates pocket. That all her outfits don't have good pockets. And it is filled with, as you put on your imaginary thinking hats. There's some very nice illustrations, historical illustrations, some cartoons, some hinges, various things that went into pocket crafting. And the Jill Lepore, the wonderful New Yorker writer, gave it a wonderful plug as well. Enthralling and always surprising, a riveting centuries-long social and political history. So I would say this is for... So what, like if you had a someone in your family who likes women's history, but maybe you don't want to, you want to have something that is, that maybe not going to cause an argument at the dinner table, but instead fact will come up with many interesting facts because this is just, in a lot of ways, this is just factual and it's a nice book and it's a good price. So. Pockets, Intimate History of How We Keep Things Close by Hannah Carlson.
I'm looking at my own pair of pants, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 pockets, and a pocket inside the pocket, which I hate because if I have coins, they always get stuck in there.
I think that's actually for the coins. That's what, because when I drove here from Milwaukee, my coins all fall out of my pocket. But if I had that little extra pocket, they probably stay in.
Yeah.
But then you can't get them out when you need them.
You can't get them out when you need them.
And now, 45 minutes on pockets with Larry Mueller.
Oh, man. Join in with your own questions and comments as we move along here. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Golden, our guest, and Tyler Ditter, our engineer, says that little pocket inside the pocket, that's my guitar picks pocket. He's a good guitarist.
A little jealous, but also wondering why all the design is based around musicians. I think they...
Oh, man. Well, let's see. We've got a couple of the next two books are by some pretty well-known names. The first is by journalist Meg Kissinger.
Well-known in Milwaukee, certainly. While You Were Out, an intimate family portrait of mental illness in an era of silence. And honestly, there are actually connections between the two books. So this is a wonderful story of growing up in a very large family with mental illness. Her parents self-medicated. And I'm not giving anything away, but a couple of her siblings died of suicide, and almost every kid struggled. And she is a wonderful journalist. She wrote for the Journal Sentinel for many years, and she did a lot of investigations into the mental health industry. And this is the story behind why she's been so interested in this story. It's beautifully written. I read a book of several years ago called Hidden Valley Road by Robert Kolker, about a family of 12 in Colorado, where six of the 12 kids, almost all the boys, were diagnosed schizophrenic. And it was a spectacular book. It was an Oprah pick and things like that. And then lo and behold, when I was looking at this book, I'm like, she has a quote from him. And he'd actually been somebody she'd work with when she teaches at Columbia Journalism School. But it is, it's also, but this thing about this book is she has a journalist's eye. She really can step back from, and that's something also that I really like in a memoirs, when somebody can step back and tell a story that's not about themselves, but that's part of the story.
Yeah.
And I also like that she does have a great sense of humor, an appropriate sense of humor, and also that it's it's all the book set in the North Chicago suburbs in Milwaukee, which was, so it gives you a really strong sense of place.
And she's a really good writer.
The writing is terrific. And it's very compelling and really well written.
So the other book, the author may be more well known, Henry Winkler, also known as the Fonz, of course. I've heard wonderful things about the man himself, but what was going on with him when he had such a fast rise to fame?
Well, I try to read at least one celebrity bio a year. I start others and I don't get through them. They 25 pages. But I was intrigued about this book and couldn't stop reading. This was actually, the Fonz was one of his first jobs out of acting school. It was a bit part and that exploded. The first season of Happy Days didn't do very well. And so they refocused the story, made it like less, like a lot of these television series, like less authentic. And he started becoming the focus of the story. So, there's so many stories about this Urkel and, in Family Matters and Kramer and Seinfeld, where they're the ones who get all the laughs. But he didn't really want that. And to the point where at one point they talked about renaming the show Fonz's Happy Days. And first of all, on one hand, he was very close to Ron Howard. And he didn't like the way Ron Howard was treated, but he also wanted to protect his friendship, which he was able to do. That's how amazing a person he was. But also he felt like a fraud because he had had a lifelong, his parents treated him very poorly, and he had a lifelong dyslexia that was undiagnosed until his adulthood. The other thing was, I don't think he really... he's been a good sport about it, but I don't think he wanted to be known for the Fonz. And I felt like much of the rest of his career was kind of running away from it, despite a big picture of the Fonz on the back of the book and a Fonz in the title. Mm-hmm. He was very proud of his other work and won actually an Emmy for his work in Barry, the Bill Hader series from recent times. I loved him in Children's Hospital. I loved him in Arrested Development. And he's had all these books about kids with dyslexia. It's just, he's so self-effacing. He's still like a 12, he meets another celebrity and he's like, he's 12. Like, I just want his autograph. That's all. I just found it delightful. I wish he would have come. We didn't get on the tour, but maybe an organization will bring him one day. I did say to the publisher, so all these other places that got Henry Winkler, they all have statues of him downtown. but they laughed, but I didn't go anywhere with it. So
Linda wants to know what you think of Killers of the Flower Moon.
Oh, that's such a great book. And obviously, there is the Apple. It's actually in theaters now, but it is an Apple series. It'll be on Apple Plus, Apple soon. David Grand's The Wager is getting some of the best reviews of the year. I believe it is on the Times top 10, somebody's top 10 for the year, somebody big. And that's another book that you would think, it's about a ship. It's a naval book, which we haven't had very much of in a number of years, but people really love it. But, Kills of the Flower Moon is I know it's had a little bit of controversy in the film of some people questioning various things about roles. It's a very compelling book. I love narrative nonfiction with a little crime. I think in the summer. So this was another big problem for Larry is that I had so many books I loved in the first half of the year. I was like, I can't repeat them. But unless somebody says, what did you think of David Gran? And I would say, I think you should read Fever in the Heartland by Timothy Egan about the second coming of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana. If you like David Gran type books and you've read all of them.
Daniel Golden, our guest today. And by the way, his list... which I promise we'll get to the whole list, is available. he typed up the list for us, and we've got it on our page. So if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry, and go to today's date under the comments section. We'll have it there for sure. I promise you. Larry Mueller here for the Ideas Network. Daniel Golden has put together a wonderful list of books he's recommending for gifts for the holidays, or maybe just a gift for yourself. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with him. It's been great fun so far. If you have a suggestion, we'd love to hear from you about it. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Lance emailed to ask if you've heard of the book North Woods by Mason.
Oh, Daniel Mason, yes. And that is showing up on a lot of best of lists. It's a really interesting, I loved his last novel, The Winter Soldier, but I haven't made it. He came, so I read it. I haven't made it all the way through this yet, but it's basically, I love books that kind of focus on a house or an object or even a series of books, which are all in the same house. And so this is it's a piece of land over the course of hundreds of years telling what happened to it. And each part of the book is told sort of, it gets progressively modern in style, and it's showing up in top tens all over the place. People are loving it.
Linda would like to know what you think. Mary emailed, and is it just me, or is the print getting smaller in books? Do publishers do this to save money? I no longer order from Amazon. It's okay because now I support local bookstores, so I like that better.
Oh, well, yes. So it is a way to save money. I will tell you that the print in a hardcover is almost always larger than a print in the paperback. You can see they used to do a thing called a rebind where they take the hardcover, tear the covers off, and just turn it into a paperback. They don't do that. No, but almost nobody does that anymore. So you'll see a smaller trim size on a paperback, and that means the print has to be smaller. You will see, especially university presses, you'll find a 200-page book that feels like it was 400 pages, and they have tiny print and tiny margins. But we always see, you really have to look at each book, which is another reason to browse, to see if it works for you. And okay, maybe you're going to say, I'm only going to read books where I like the print. I will tell you that I've heard booksellers and customers alike say, I can't read the book because I don't like the typeface. So, yeah. Or the spacing or the margins off or something like that. And, you know, the reading is a very physical experience. You know, when you read a physical book, it's a physical experience. And I would say there are plenty of books with decent type size. But I will say that sometimes it might mean the pages are thinner or the pages are lower quality. It really just depends on the budget.
Yeah, the other thing that bothers me is that once in a while I'll pick up a book and it'll be too light. The type itself will, or it doesn't match the color. You know, sometimes I've had books that have like a sort of an off, the light yellow or off.
Right.
And then the type is light.
Well, worse than light, one of the things is, books can be physical, but they can still be print on demand. And sometimes they're blurry. They're using old, they're especially with classics. You'll open it up and say, what is this, like a mimeograph of the book? Which only people of a certain age will know even what that is. But I do love to use the word mimeograph a lot. And because it'll seem like they just like copied. It's a copy of a copy of a copy. I agree with you on the light, and especially if you have poor quality paper. And, you know, there are books where I laugh and say, oh, you can read, this is such a great book because you can read both sides of the page without turning it and save energy. So I don't like that either. Yeah, you got to browse and find sometimes it means your favorite book. You go, I don't know, I'm doing something else with that book, you know, reading it in a different way. But there are plenty of books still being published very nicely.
I still like the book. To read a book and have the book in my hands as opposed to trying to read it online digitally. But if I had to read a book like that and I really wanted to, then I get the digital copy, and I hate reading the
digital copy. Yeah, it's good that you can raise print size and things like that. So, yeah. You know, I like I said, I'm only talking about the insides of books today, except when I guess when I'm not. But I'm not making any judgments on anything.
Well, let's talk about the next book on your list. And we just covered it last week. It's titled The Core of the Onion. And I really liked it.
So did I. And I knew that you did it. So I thought, well, this is a quickie, peeling the rarest common food featuring more than 100 historical recipes. Everybody who's listening at should go back and listen to the whole program because he's a delightful interviewer. I loved it. I want to know, like, it's historical. It's from a world perspective, like customs around the world, kind of organized by the different ways you cook an onion, which I found really interesting.
Yeah.
And I want to know, have you started turning on your faucet when you when you cut an onion now since reading this book?
I actually had to. I made what is called cheesy potatoes for Thanksgiving, and I had several onions to cut up, and I put them under the water.
Yeah. I do the other thing he said, which is refrigerate them. My onions are always cold. But I did. I actually did try it. I don't – for some reason, I'm less – you know, I'm very lucky. I don't cry that much when I cut onions. But I have to say, I'm more of a connoisseur of garlic. So, you know, I don't really cry from garlic. So what can I say? I like a leek. You know, I'm going to raid all of these shallots I don't know what to do with. So there you go.
Well, he was a lot of fun to talk to, for sure. And we have a picture book next. It's Wombat.
It's my transitional book. So I know you always have the folks from the Madison Center for the kids' books.
Cooperative Children's Book Center.
Wonderful segment. So I said, I don't need to duplicate that, but I bet they wouldn't do this book. So this is the backstory for this book, Wombat by Philip Bunting, is we all go to conferences. And we were very lucky this year that the children's bookseller, the National Children's Bookseller Conference, was in Milwaukee. So I wouldn't normally go, but I went. And one of the things that we do is we listen to a lot of people present books. And it is actually, there's, you know, sessions and autographing and that kind of thing. But it, the most polite thing to do if you do is the publishers really subsidize a lot of the cost. So you really have to sit when they say it's a session where you're going to listen to people talk about books. You have to sit and listen to it because it's not fair for them to go, say, fishing or something during it. So this is one of the books that they presented from an independent publisher called Charles Bridge. And it is a picture book about wombats. And I feel like Philip Bunting, who is from Australia, but lives, I think, in the he lives in Australia, but I think he grew up in the UK. I think this is his attempt to make the wombat America's favorite marsupial, knocking out the kangaroo and the koala bear. And so nobody can see. It's very cute. So I must read a little bit of the story. Wombat, two bats, three bats, more bats, little bat, middle bat, rubber bat, top hat, square bat, round bat, long bat, splat bat, happy bat, grumpy bat, doormat, fruit bat. It goes on. Everyone has a funny illustration. It works really well as a picture book. We're selling it very well, especially when I recite it to people. But it will probably be a board book next year, and then I think it will do even better.
So, oh, that's wonderful. Jim emailed to ask if you read the new Nicholas Sparks, or if you've read the new Nicholas Sparks book.
I wonder what he thought of it.
He wondered what your thoughts are. What about Nicholas Sparks as an author?
Well, he is. He's been writing for a long time now. You know, the interesting thing about him, a lot of, you know, he did have that run where so many of his books were adapted to movies.
Movies, yeah.
He has talked about how his idea was to find a space in the market. And he said, there are so many romance writers, but there are very few male romance writers who write from the perspective, like who say, aren't writing as a woman secretly, nom de plumes, so to speak. And that was his decision to write commercial romance fiction as a man. And he lucked out. He's now published, I think, by Random House and Dell, but Grand Central had a kind of a machine going at the time with commercial fiction in the way that I don't think we see quite as much as we used to, where Grand Central and I think Putnam, when they were independent, and a few other publishers would just like build an author, and they would go bang, 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 much like James Patterson. One or two books a year. We were talking about John Sanford. And they would always be bestsellers, and they would have a very strong profile such that you didn't really need to know what was in it. You're just like, I like Nicholas Sparks books. I like so-and-so. I'm going, you know, W.E.B. Griffin. I like... You know, and you would just buy
John
the next
Connolly.
One. Yeah. And it didn't really need independent bookstores because, honestly, you're talking everyone you talk to, they'll say, I like them or I don't like them. And the books are so similar to each other. You know, they have a very similar rhythm to them that it's hard to say this one's different from this one. You know, the thing about a lot of literary authors is they write, they used to say commercial writers write the same book on the outside. Literary writers are kind of writing the same book on the inside, but the outside wrapping is very different each time. That's a little blur. That's kind of a truism that's not true. But it is true that, you know, if you're a commercial writer and you've got a New York Times bestseller every time and then you write something very different, then the publisher doesn't want you to do that. They're like, no, we're going to lose the market. And they'll never buy you again because you wrote this different kind of book.
Weird book.
Yeah. So that's my take on Nicholas Sparks.
And let's see. Oh, we got an email. What makes a good picture book? Back to the picture book.
Oh, well, you know, there are different things that make it. Because, for example, the New York Times Best Illustrated Book list, which anybody can find online, those are amazing books, but they're really focusing on the artwork. Interestingly enough, the biggest prize from the, there's the Newbery and the Caldecott. And the Caldecott is an illustration prize. And the Newbery is a writing prize. It mostly goes to middle grade and young adult, but every so often it goes for a picture book. So they're really two different components. Obviously, people want one that works well together. I will tell you, if you're planning to write a picture book, the biggest mistake that we're back to this small press workshop, you know, our contract publishing workshop. People put too many words in. And we'll get one of a locally published picture book, and I'm like, yeah, this is like for a 12-year-old.
We'll be back. We will be back right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Talking about books that make great gifts or gift for yourself or just for someone else. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Daniel Golden back with us, owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Do you have a book you read each year during the holidays? What's your favorite book that's Wisconsin related, perhaps? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. We have a few books next to talk about, Daniel, a few novels, especially, and one that Jill really liked. So let's talk about that right away. It's Tom Lake by Ann Patchett.
Well, this book came out over the summer. Sorry about that. And has been a huge success. Ann Patchett is one of the most beloved authors writing today. Certainly our customers love her. She's also been a champion of bookstores. She has Parnassus and often is talked to by the media when people are talking about the state of the stores. The other thing that's kind of amazing about her is her recommendations are very, very, very popular. But this is her first book in a few years, and it is set in Michigan in a summer of COVID. When the family is on the family runs a cherry farm, and the kids come home, probably wouldn't have come home much anymore. I don't think at least two of the three weren't planning to be cherry farmers. And the mother has this past as an actress, and they have made these ideas of what the mom's past was, and she tells them the story. Her books are always about family. They are always about relationships and storytelling. This book is interesting because it is inspired in part and definitely plays around with Our Town, the Thornton Wilder play, as well as The Cherry Orchard, obviously. But Our Town, I think part of Ann Patchett's great hope was that more people would read Our Town from this. I love the book. It's one of my top 10 of the year. I'm not doing much event plugging, but I will note that, in fact, we have a lot of programs coming up. I didn't mention any of them except for this one, which is next Wednesday at the Oriental Theater in Milwaukee, December 6th. This was ticketed. So you get a book. You might have read it already, but hey, it's December. Maybe you have some occasion coming up where you give books to people, if we're lucky. But I know so many people whose it's on their favorite book list. So warm, so smart. She doesn't have kids, and she gets, I've heard from so many parents that she gets the parent-child relationship so well. She's charming and self-effacing and a good writer. I love her. Yeah. I will say, so we have this rec table of Ann Patchett recs, especially because I'm bringing some to the event. And the problem is every time we get some from her publicist or from her, I read this book, I really like it. And then like I turn around and she does a video or there's an NPR piece and all the books disappear. And I can't get them. So I was talking about a book that I thought you would like called The Comfort of Crows by Margaret Rankle.
Yes.
Which she is a huge fan of. And then there's another book that is that I was going to recommend. The book that nobody has right now is, The English Understand Wool by Helen DeWitt. That's the one. So she went to Three Lives in New York, and she said, "What are you selling?" And they said, "We love this book. We've sold hundreds of copies." And so she went on, talked about it, sold out the entire print run, and then NPR did a story about it. It's a couple years old. It's from this New Directions, like, fairy tale series, which is sort of also a take on publishing, which has been a big thing to take on publishing, like Yellowface, which is one of the hot books of the year by And so that, you know, it's just whatever. Now, I will say that my next book on the list is actually one of the Ann Patchett recommendations.
Absolution. And that the last one was
Tom Lake. We're going to repeat them more by popular request.
The next one is Absolution by Alice McDermott.
Now, Alice McDermott is one of my favorite writers. I've read everything except, I guess, her high school notebooks, but she's just an amazing writer. She really writes. She's not a religious writer, but she writes from the Catholic experience. Mm-hmm. Most of her books have been set in New York City. Charming Billy is one of my favorites, At Weddings and Wakes. That Night, from her very first book, set in the New York City boroughs and then the suburbs where they wind up living. This book has a larger canvas, but it is about a young New York woman who goes with her husband to Vietnam in the first years of not when the United States was fully involved in the Vietnam War, or as the Vietnamese would say, the American War, but when they were consulting. And it is about a young, sort of innocent woman. She's having trouble getting pregnant. She befriends an older, more experienced woman who's kind of a mover and shaker, but a little manipulative, who comes up with this scheme to raise money for charity by dressing Barbie dolls, and she didn't even know the movie was coming, in traditional Vietnamese outfits. And needless to say, it's just one of the many ways that we look at the past and go, eeks, you know. Yeah. It's beautifully written. I always used to say Alice McDermott like spends a week on each sentence. And it's a very interesting book about friendship as well. It turns out that she's having a conversation. The book is a conversation between that younger, more innocent woman and the daughter of the other woman. Mm. But it's also, there's a very interesting Catholic perspective on it, because I never really thought about this about the Vietnam War. Her husband, who's very religious, she is not as religious, sees it as a religious war because the people, the leaders are Catholic, but the rebels are Buddhist.
Oh.
And you know, you get from the idea that this was not that unusual a perspective to take, but it was something that I had never, and I've read both fiction and nonfiction about the Vietnam War, and I didn't really
I had not
take that in perspective.
No, I didn't either.
Beautiful book.
Absolution is the name of the book. And the next novel is by Nathan Hill. You have many more women novelists on the list this year, by the way. Is that a trend you're seeing?
No, it's just a trend. Yes, it's a trend I'm seeing of things I read. So I will say, if I make a list that's like six women and a man, I don't get in trouble. But if I make a list that's like seven men, somebody's going to complain to me. So,
And the book's called Wellness.
Wellness
by
Nathan Hill. Well, the thing, so here's the trick. He's a man who kind of writes in some vernacular of some of my favorite fiction written by women. And so there was a book I really loved called in the spring called Pineapple Street that I talked about here, mm-hmm. By Jenny Jackson. There was a book last year called Marrying the Ketchups that I really loved that I talked about here by Jennifer Close. And in some ways, this book is like that. It's 30 years of a marriage that starts with the two of them seeing each other from across an alley where they're looking at each other in the apartment building and finally get together, to 30 years later when the bloom is off the rose, but and all they want is to move from their crappy apartment in Wicker Park to a fancier condo development in an unnamed but sort of Lake Forest-esque Chicago suburb where their kid will be in a better school, et cetera, et cetera. But the book is not, so it's got that sort of comedy, you know, family comedy kind of perspective, but it's also a much bigger book about all kinds of ideas about sort of reality and artificiality. So he's a photographer whose photography is so technical that there's actually no photograph involved. It's just the chemicals. And she is a psychologist who runs a wellness clinic, but it's really a placebo clinic. So nobody's actually getting anything. And it's all in the psychology of how they're presented. Because the key on placebos is they only work when you don't know they're placebos. And so the book is packed with factual information. So in that way, it's sort of like it's got a nerdy boyness that's not always in those women writers. They're like, yeah, I'm not doing all that research. But he's got these massive, like, directory at the back. The other thing, he's got a swing for the fences kind of mentality that I really love. You can see, like, the influences, especially of John Irving in the story, mm-hmm. in the kind of the over-the-topness. He wrote a book called The Knicks about seven years ago, which was like 800 pages or something. This is 600 pages. But as I was saying, it's 600, but it reads like 400. And because it's very kind of breezy. But he always does this sort of crazy. That book, the last book, I read them both together just to be crazier. And that book had like a 70-page segment that was all through the perspective of somebody playing a video game. And it was all reflected on this guy playing. This book has this very long segment on the deterioration of the guy and the relationship with his dad all through, wait for it, Facebook algorithms. And of course, Facebook does it like, and how, I don't know, do you remember when you first went on social media and you're like, everything I say is being liked by hundreds of people? This wouldn't be for you, but for the average person. And then suddenly you're on it for a few months and like, and now it's only liked by like 10 people. Like, what happened? And it gets you to kind of go on it more. And the way that like certain controversial things will, like when you say something controversial, when you link to something, you know, it gets you more hits. And it's about the deterioration of his dad's relationship. Now, he couldn't, Facebook wouldn't talk to him. He had no way of really getting any information with him, except their patents are public. He read all the patents. Is that amazing? And he was able to do it through the patents. I really, this is, you know, in contention for my favorite book of the year.
And Nathan Hill and Wellness.
Wellness, yep.
Dennis in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. At night, BBC has Outlook that's broadcast on an ideas network.
Yeah.
And last night they had an interview with Patricia Cornwell, she talked about some of her books are inspired by her life and how her books affect her life. And I'm wondering, as far as with appliances, there's usually like factory seconds where they're dented or scratched. I wonder, well, what happens to books when they're not quite printed? right, quite right, or maybe they're ripped.
Oh, they're sent back and destroyed.
Yeah, they're just sent
back. There are, if a book is in a warehouse and is not damaged, but it just wasn't sellable, or returned, say, and it was maybe a little shop-worn, there's a secondary market, either in the United States or abroad, where they'll sell them at a much lower rate, you know, a much lower cost. The author doesn't get the royalty on that generally. But Scarpetta was a medical examiner before, you know, Patricia Cornwell,
yes,
who wrote the K. Scarpetta books, that one of which came out this week, A Natural Death, was in the field.
We have we've got a lot of books to go through here. Yeah. Let's look at the next book on the list, The Secret Book of Flora Lee, set in World War II.
Yes, I am always looking. I have a bookseller I worked with for many years named Jane, and I'm always looking. She's retired and doesn't read as many new books. She rereads her old books. She loves British writers, and but I'm always looking for the book for the people who come in, what is Jane reading? Now, I can't lie. I don't lie. But I do say, well, I think Jane would like this book. So I call it a Jane pick. So this is a book. Patty Callahan Henry has written a lot of books, contemporary fiction, historical fiction. This is very different, but it grew out of a series of books she wrote about C.S. Lewis. She wrote a book called Becoming Mrs. Lewis, which was very popular. And then she wrote a book about how C.S. Lewis, the things in C.S. Lewis's lives that affected his writing of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And she said, I want to write a fairy tale myself. So what she did is sort of wrote one. So it's set in two time periods, 1960 or so, an antiquarian bookseller, last day on her job before she goes to work at Big Sotheby's, gets a book in the mail. Her boss has, it's a very popular children's book. It's illustrated, and they've bought some original illustrations. And she starts reading the book and says, hey, wait a minute. These are the stories that I used to tell my sister when we were sent to the countryside during Operation Pied Piper to avoid the Blitz.
Yeah.
But my sister died. She drowned. So how are these stories in this book? And then it goes back. So that's the contemporary mystery. And then she goes back to the 1940s where you're hearing the story as it happens. This is this is a book that I read.
Book.
Yeah, I read, you know, it came out in May. I didn't read it at first. And then several booksellers and a customer told me how much, I listened to people. I really did.
Yeah.
I don't listen to everybody, but I listen to people. And they told me how much they liked it. And I said, I can sell this book if it's good. And it's really fun. There was a book called The 13th Tale years ago that I liked. People who come into bookstores like books about booksellers. They like mysteries and they like World War II. And they like sibling stories, and they did a nice job. Look, it's an iridescent river. It's a river, as one of my friends said. It's also a river novel, which are very popular.
The Secret Book of Flora Lee is the title, and let's take a look at. Your next book is unusual because it was written about 100 years ago.
I know. I have this thing. I don't do it enough, but I am always looking for an old book that people might not know about, or at least the person I happen to say, do you know about this book, might not know about. So it's called Ex-Wife by Ursula Parrott. And it actually came into my hands because we worked with the UWM Film Studies Department to do an event for the biographer of Ursula Parrott called Becoming the Ex-Wife. So so we were talking to the author, and she said, oh, you should bring in Ex-Wife, her book, which was just published by McNally Editions, which is an imprint of a wonderful bookstore in New York City. It's actually a very nice book with French flaps and a colored end paper. And it's selling very well at my events. Well, it turned out our event was mostly film students who didn't buy that book. But we had a pile, so I read it. And then, lo and behold, the woman who owns Goodland, the gift shop next door to us, is a wonderful gift shop. She goes on a lot of shopping trips. She went to New York. She came back. She read the book. She loved it. Then, after I'm staring at this big pile of books I didn't sell, and my sister Meryl calls and says, I read this book that I really liked. I didn't buy it from you because I didn't think you'd have it. My friend Beth told me about it, called Ex-Wife. I'm like, oh, crap. And I'm staring at the pile. So I don't make her buy them. I just give them to her. But you know, I buy them for her. So the book is set in the 1920s. It is about the dissolution of marriage. It is a roaring 20s novel. It was the first novel. It was actually adapted into a movie that won an Oscar, I believe, for the best actress. I never remember. It's not called Ex-Wife. It coined the term Ex-Wife, and this book outsold The Great Gatsby in the 1920s 3-1.
Wow.
And the book was, has now sunk into, she died penniless. She wrote a lot of books. She wrote a lot of screenplays. A lot of people don't know that The Great Gatsby was not a huge hit. Initially, it wasn't until the 1940s reissue that his friends kind of, as this does happen, it happens all the time. Friends help make the book sort of a modern classic. There's no dish on Great Gatsby. It's a wonderful book, but every wonderful book needs some help. That's what marketing is all about. And this book didn't get that help. So it's very much an interesting book about the time period, about from a woman's perspective about this dissolution of the marriage, and a lot about kind of she's in advertising. So there's interesting to read a book that had, you know, about somebody in the advertising field whose book didn't get the marketing later on that it should have gotten. Anyway, if it's not in public domain, it's close to it. But this edition is, for that person who is complaining about books that are difficult to read, it's not the biggest typeface in the world, but it's certainly acceptable. The paper's very nice, and it's actually a joy to read. And so we've been doing very well with it.
So, Ex-Wife. And then, I think we have time to get one more in here. Let Us Descend.
Well, we have a few more books. Let Us Descend was my literary take. I thought, she's written Sing Unburied Sing and Salvage the Bones, more contemporary novels. This is beautiful.
Set in the Civil War.
This is about the Civil War, about an enslaved woman who's basically transferred through the slave markets in New Orleans from one plantation to another. It's got a spirit mother and a spirit involved that talks to her. The book got amazing reviews. It was an Oprah Book Club. It hasn't been showing up on Best of Lists, and I was kind of shocked about it because the reviews would indicate otherwise. But maybe they said, Jesmyn Ward has had enough acclaim. Let her sell herself. But I said, no, Daniel will help. It is a beautiful book. It's a bit of a different take. A brutal book, but hopeful too. There's a piece of hope in it. And I just want to say, we were talking about books of the year, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and I should probably mention the Heaven on Earth Grocery Store, which is showing up on all the best of lists about a community in Pennsylvania with a Jewish community that becomes mostly black, and about how this grocery store stays behind and they help hide a kid from going to being taken away from the family. Everybody's loving it. And we were talking about how this book, The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride, I'm sure B&M will have a special edition, but everybody's selling it well. And I think you would like it, and maybe you'll buy it. So who's to say?
I think I might. I think I might need
book about community. I write books about bookstores as community, movie theaters community. This is about grocery store as community.
I love it. And we have a few more left, but I tell you what, we have the list posted on the Larry Mueller Show page, ideas@wpr.org/Larry. Go there under today's date. And for those, as somebody said, they didn't have access to the internet, if you want to send me a letter or send me a note, I will send you a print copy.
Oh.
I will send you a print copy of that list. So just write to in care of Larry Mueller for WPR.org. WPR. 821 University Avenue, Madison, and I'll get it, and I'll send you a list right in the mail. Daniel, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we will look forward to your next visit, probably the spring, the summer reading list. We'll look at that. Thank you. This is a blast. Really appreciate it. Daniel Golden, if you're in Milwaukee, take a look at stop by Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, or just go online to Boswell Books, and you will be very entertained indeed. Well, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. We got another list tomorrow. We'll take a look at gardening gifts to give during the holidays. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.